Thank you and welcome. This is a new Society of Thoracic Surgeons roundtable discussion, and we are discussing our clinical trials representative, cultural and demographic barriers to patient enrollment. I think this will be a very informative roundtable, and we have two really interesting guests who are leaders in clinical trials in thoracic oncology in our nation. To introduce myself, I am Dr. David Cook. I'm the head of general thoracic surgery at UC Davis Health, and we're going to go around and introduce ourselves.
Okay. My name is Loretta Irunse. I'm a thoracic surgeon at City of Hope, where I do health disparities and social determinants research.
And I'm Linda Martin. I'm a thoracic surgeon at the University of Virginia.
So health disparities is a critical problem in our country, both for underrepresented groups, socioeconomic status, gender and sex disparities for women. Despite this, cancer and cardiovascular disease are significant problems in African-American communities and other communities, as well as women. Lung cancer is the number one cancer killer for women. In our country, the NIH, as well as the Institutes of Medicine, have mandated that determinants of health and differences in sex be incorporated within clinical trials and research, and that underrepresented groups are enrolled into clinical trials. Yet, women and underrepresented minorities, such as African Americans, are enrolling in clinical trials at much less rates than non-white individuals, as well as men. So today, we're going to sort of discuss some of those determinants of health and some of those barriers for enrollment in clinical trials. And we're going to talk about strategies for improving that gap in our clinical trial system in the country. So first, let me start off with Loretta. Why is it important to have diverse representation in regards to race, ethnicity, and sex in clinical trials?
Excellent question. I think there are several reasons why. First, it's important to understand that there are differences in genetic mutations or epigenetic changes based on race and economics and ethnicity. And the truth is, it's hard to have patients in clinical trials and have a good understanding of whether our intervention or treatments are actually effective if we just have one type of person or one type of group. And so the point is simply that, for instance, we know that African Americans, particularly men, have the highest death rate from lung cancer, but we may not know the best way to treat them if they're not included in the clinical trials. And so we won't know, for instance, whether their differences in genetic mutations will impact the targeted therapy or the immunotherapy that we might try to treat them with. We have an understanding, for instance, that African Americans have higher levels of KRAS mutations, and that Asian patients have higher levels of EGFR mutations. Well, if you don't have a good breakdown of the different patients or different ethnicities, then you really won't know whether treatments are actually able to treat all of them.
That's very on point. You know, Linda, when you say you look at lung cancer screening and it's a low-dose CT scan, why would race or sex have any difference when it comes to a CT scanner?
So the CT scanner isn't the issue, it's the diseases that we detect. And as the three of us know, but maybe not everyone in our audience knows, is that a substantial number of the nodules that we find on lung cancer screening prove to be benign, and that the sort of the rubber meets the road where we figure out which ones are the high-risk lesions that need more invasive procedures and which ones are safe to be watched. And if you don't include a diverse group of ethnicities and gender in the study, then you may only know what happens in white males when they get a lung cancer screening and what a white male's lung lesion is likely to go on to do. We've learned that there are populations of non-smoking Asian women that have ground glass lesions on their scans, and those all may be early adenocarcinomas, and they may benefit from screening in a way that's very different than a white man would benefit from screening. But if there aren't enough of that particular population represented in the National Lung Screening Trial, it just doesn't inform your decision making. Mm-hmm. I could also say from the flip side, I've heard of people just deciding to include non-smoking Asian women in lung cancer screening as they implement it. And I applaud their interest in helping that population, but they're doing it without data.
Yeah.
And that's again where we need to go back to the drawing board and make sure that we're including a diverse population when we try to establish the standards to begin with.
You know, we look at a not a US trial, but a large population trial, such as the Nelson trial, which was recently concluded. And the results are exciting. 26% reduction of cancer-specific mortality in patients undergoing low-dose CT scan screening for lung cancer. And interesting enough, 39 to 60% reduction in mortality in women. But it comes with a caveat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Loretta?
Yeah. So unfortunately, there were very few women in the cohort. And so the question right now for us is, you know, how generalizable are the results? You know, can we make the assumption that this will persist if we had equal numbers or closer to equal numbers of women in the group? And that again is that's the whole problem with underrepresentation within our trials, is that we get an answer, but then we think, well, is this answer true? And so we just have to do a better job about getting patients in.
You know, that leads to, so what are the factors of poor enrollment of minorities in the clinical trials? We'll talk a little bit later about trial design and how we can improve that. But from the patient's perspective, what are some of the factors? Perhaps looking at the African-American community, there could be a layer of distrust of healthcare in some African-Americans. Loretta, do you want to talk about why that may be?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment is very well known, I think. But one of the issues with that experiment, which was many, many years ago, is that, you know, many African Americans did lose trust in the healthcare system. But if you were to, I think we have enough data that shows now that African Americans want to partner with their healthcare providers, and they want to trust their healthcare because they understand that it's very important for their long-term and their prognosis. And so what we're starting to understand now is that the whole distrust conversation that we've had is a superficial one. And we really have to go deeper and understand that once African Americans and other minorities are truly engaged by their providers, then they really are able to join trials, and they really are able to be compliant. And so it's not a, well, African Americans distrust because of past wrongs that unfortunately the healthcare system has done to them. It is now, yes, that happened, but at the same time, if we take the extra step to truly explain, educate, and engage, then they are very happy to move forward and join. But it is important to also understand that there might be other, social determinants, or there might be other barriers and challenges that we have to also discuss in order to draw them in.
So, yeah, I would like to add to that and just say, you know, there's a few factors at play here on both sides of this. So there's patient factors, and there's this phenomenon called volunteer bias, that people who decide to participate in trials are not necessarily representative of all of our civilization, that some people just, I don't know, for some reason have a certain motivation. Maybe they're the worried well, whatever you want to call it, and they may be more interested in participating. So you're going to get a different slice of the population often than you would otherwise. The other side of it is that as providers, we're guilty of not always giving the opportunities to every patient, that providers maybe unconsciously make a judgment and say, I don't think this patient's going to be able to follow through with all the responsibilities of the trial, or they have transportation issues, or something like that, who knows, but that they don't offer an opportunity to participate where maybe they should be. And so those are, I think, education issues. The other thing that's the bigger picture is it takes time to talk to a patient. Like you're saying, build that trusting relationship with your patient, mm-hmm. such that you can then explore the idea of a clinical trial, take the time to explain the trial, answer all of their questions, allay their fears and concerns about whether they're going to be getting a placebo or not, if they're going to be considered an experiment. You know, there's a lot of preconceived notions, and it takes time to dispel all those problems and rumors. And in our current medical compensation system, you don't get paid to spend that extra half an hour, 45 minutes with mm-hmm. the patient. Mm-hmm. And it's not that we're motivated by the almighty dollar, it's that we have more patients in the waiting room waiting for us, and you can't spend an hour with a patient when it's a 15-minute visit.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think our system needs to put more importance on trials, and in so doing, give us the time and the resources we need to do this, because it's so important
Absolutely.
To be recruiting Absolutely. A broadly representative group of patients.
Yeah, you talk about the system putting more importance on clinical trials. A study done querying the California Cancer Registry saw that specifically for lung cancer, those individuals who participate in lung cancer clinical trials have a slightly better mortality. Than patients who don't. So clinical trials can help people even though they're experimental. So Linda, provide me with some advice if you present a novel trial that you feel that they would benefit from, but the patient says to you, there's a 50% chance I may get placebo. I don't want to be a guinea pig. How is this going to help me? How do you describe the benefit of enrolling into a clinical trial for that individual?
So the way I tackle that, and it's never an easy conversation to explain all of the intricacies of trial design and so forth, but if for there to be a placebo arm on a study, that corresponds to current standard of care. So I remind the patient that they're getting exactly what they would get off of the trial, and that there's a chance they may get something in addition to that. So they're never going to get less than optimal care. They're just going to get optimal care plus or not, but at least it'll be optimal care. And the other thing I talk to them about is that when people are on clinical trials, there's just a lot of extra layers of oversight, and I see that as a big benefit, because that means there's a whole army of people who are making sure they're on schedule with their follow-up appointments, that all of their records are properly reviewed, all of their labs are properly reviewed. There's often multiple additional reviews of their biopsy specimens and radiology studies. So they get sort of like quadruple layers of extra care. And I see that only as a positive, that there's just more people looking out for them to stay on schedule and stay on standard of care.
And many clinical trials that a patient might be benefiting from occur at comprehensive cancer centers. And you talk about that extra layer of support and benefit. Enrolling in a clinical trial may allow you to be a part of that comprehensive cancer center and getting that extra benefit.
That's right. And we see that, you know, we have many patients who are referred to our center primarily for the clinical trials. And I think that that's a huge benefit of being a part of a cancer center. And I would say, to piggyback on what Linda was talking about, it's very important to, again, as we try to support our patients, some of whom have different issues, that we look for opportunities. For instance, you know, do they need more navigation? Do they, you know, how can we really, you know, sort of get them through from the beginning to the end, not only the trial, but of their healthcare? And I think that's what our underrepresented minority patients, our female patients, the patients that we haven't been able to reach out to, sometimes they need more support, and we just have to know that.
You know, we look at, you mentioned some of adjuncts to help people enroll in clinical trials, such as navigators. Let's talk a little bit about women in particular. You look at certain disease processes like breast cancer, and it seems like enrollment in breast cancer clinical trials may not be that as big of an issue. Are there lessons learned in that care community?
My take on this as a non-breast cancer physician, full disclosure, I think an issue here is twofold. Number one, breast cancer patients tend to be a younger age population than we see in lung and esophageal cancer, so probably by 20 or 30 years younger on average. And they tend to be more engaged in social media and education and so forth, so they're going to be much more aware of clinical trial opportunities. The fact that there's not a stigma associated with that diagnosis, I think, is a major factor, because in my experience, their friends and family just rally around them, and they have not just the patient looking out for what opportunities there are, but they have this whole group of people who are doing their homework and finding out what trials they might qualify for, and they're there to help with childcare so they can make it to their appointment or make it to get this chemo infusion. They have a bigger underlying support structure, and I feel like that is lacking a lot of times in the disease that carries some stigma with them. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's part of it, but then there's also just the fact that they're a younger population. It's easier for them to get to and from appointments and stay on track. Their health is generally better, mm-hmm. and the operations done for breast cancer surgery are not as difficult to recover from. Right. So I think those are all factors mm-hmm. that are in play. Mm-hmm. But I also think maybe we need to take some lessons from breast cancer researchers and finding out what are they doing to have such great trial enrollment. Is there anything else that we haven't thought of that we could or should be doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the stigma is a fascinating topic in regards to breast cancer, which lacks stigma. It's almost a joyous club for a very difficult and serious problem. Yet in lung cancer, there is a stigma.
Absolutely. Well, I will tell you, you know, we see it all the time. You know, unfortunately, it's still considered a smoker's disease. And so for whatever, you know, and so the lung cancer rates are because of the smoking. And so if a person is sort of struggling with or dying from the disease, that is their issue. And what I would say is, you know, we understand that stigma can lead to social isolation, and when you have social isolation, that's also a determinant that impacts your long-term outcomes and your mortality, and it also will impact your ability to go to, you know, to be a part of a clinical trial. It impacts every aspect of your care.
Yeah.
And so I would say certainly stigma is a very complicated issue that unfortunately our patients see at higher rates, and it impacts every part of their care.
You know, there are several strategies to reach out to communities to promote enrollment, community outreach, especially in the African American community, going into community centers and churches and other areas. We talked about peer navigators. Linda, talk a little bit about what the Alliance for Clinical Trials is doing to promote diversification of their enrollees.
So the Alliance for Clinical Trials is one of four major cooperative oncology groups sponsored by the National Cancer Institute. And I'm sure this is a parallel effort in all the cooperative groups. I can speak to what the Alliance does. They have a specific committee called the Health Disparities Committee, and their role is to make sure that there's many fold, but they look to make sure that issues such as gender, age, racial, ethnic status, socioeconomic status, geography, such as rural versus urban, and they're even adding now a sexual and gender minority component to that. And they review every trial that goes to the Alliance is reviewed to make sure there's no warning signs that there could be disparities that result from the way the trial is designed or how it's going to be enrolling. And they help with educational efforts for the research nurses that are involved in enrolling patients, the investigators that are designing the trials, and the other people who are participating and enrolling in the trial. And they look at all as the papers are being written and so forth, to make sure that all of those disparity issues are being considered. So there's a lot of oversight there and a lot of efforts to try to make things better. It's far from sort of solving the problem, but at least it's a positive step towards getting there.
Well, I think what we have now is created a lot of good information that will be beneficial to our thoracic surgical colleagues to help them enroll their patients in clinical trials. And also, I think it will be beneficial for patients to know that we care and that we are looking for ways to improve your health through the clinical trial network. Well, thank you very much. Again, this has been a wonderful and informative Society of Thoracic Surgeons roundtable. Thank you, Loretta, and thank you, Linda, for your wonderful insight.